Greetings, everyone. Are you ready for an accelerated course in higher consciousness? This is how our global village will get ahead of the accelerated rate of change we are now seeing in the world. It won't be with the same consciousness that created the problems we see. It will be with a new consciousness that is now evolving with the angels of our better nature. Welcome to Cosmic Love.
Greetings, everyone. This is Christopher Rudy with Cosmic Love for June 27, 2015. If you're thinking about making an independent film, want to get your script ready for a film producer, or want to learn how to obtain financing, find investors, construct a finance proposal, find the right location, acquire distribution, or any other area of filmmaking and financing, you should first consult a seasoned professional who garners an impressive track record. And that would be Franco Sama, our guest on Cosmic Love today. Thank you for being with us, Franco.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Franco, I've always been interested in the process involved with producing movies. How'd you get started doing this?
Well, I started off originally in the business as a publicist, so that was sort of a way in to be able to meet the right kind of people. Mm-hmm. And to get a little bit an introduction to the business and to the language and the terminology that is used in the film business.
Now, for neophytes, what does a publicist do in general?
Well, in my case, a publicist, you know, I had several clients, and it was my responsibility to get them press, get stories written about them in magazines, get them on radio shows like yours, or TV interviews and that kind of thing. But it was great because it gave me access. And one thing that's difficult, you know, remember this was back in 1997 when I first moved here. Things are quite different today. But either way, you know, access is one of the most important elements to success in this business. A lot of people just don't have access to the right people. And back then, being a publicist opened a lot of doors for me. It gave me opportunities to go to parties and events and places where I ordinarily probably would not have been able to get into on my own otherwise. So it was a pretty good strategy. And as a result, I met, you know, a certain group of people, set of people who were in the film business, and it allowed me to be able to learn from those people. Some of them were mentors, and some of them were just friends and consultants that I dealt with. And one thing led to another, and before I knew it, in 2005 was my first production company. I opened up a production company here in Beverly Hills with a then business partner, and we ventured off and made a couple of films early on in our career that did pretty well. They weren't theatrical releases. They were small, independent features, mostly horror movies, but it was a good way to build a foundation by doing some horror movies that made enough money to be able to justify going back to investors and doing it over and over again. So that's how I built my foundation, is by doing horror movies initially.
So your skill set, when you basically learning how to make contacts, you know, as a publicist, it's kind of evolved organically, and you kind of started at the bottom of the industry. You started with horror. It started getting your skill set together to build on, you know, what works.
Yeah, it gave me an opportunity to learn the ropes and to, you know, let other people do the heavy lifting while I kind of hung around, set, and learned the, like I said, the language and the terminology. And the truth is, it's still true today to a certain extent. Horror movies, they sort of have their own genre. It's its own genre. It's separate from the others because there's such a loyal fan base around the world. And the truth is, with a horror movie, unlike the genre movies and the other types of films that I've done movies with, you know, produced films with names like Gary Oldman and Christian Slater and David Arquette and Rebecca Fox. I mean, you need those kinds of names in order to raise the financing to be able to make the movies. But in a horror movie, that's just not the case. You can make a decent horror movie these days for, you know, $100,000 to $250,000, and because of that loyal fan base, if the movie is any good, it'll probably do okay, at least to the extent where you can recoup the investors' money for them. And the bottom line in my line of work, which is more on the financing distribution than it is on the actual physical production, it's really critically important to keep your investors whole, to make sure that they don't lose their money, and that they make profit. In fact, if you're going to have any kind of longevity in this business, you don't want to be losing money for investors. It's not a good way to start.
Well, I'm thinking about that, you know, about that fan base, that coming of age, I think, will always be a thing of overcoming fears. And so horror movies is like a challenge for not just adolescents, but the, you know, adults who, you know, still there's this thing about, it's like, you know, skiing down a mountain, you know, full tilt, where you can barely keep your balance. You know, terror kind of takes people to the edge, and there's a courage thing that comes into it.
Yeah, and they're fun. You know, they're fun. There's a difference. You know, some of the movies are quite gory, and the others can be just as thrilling and just as exciting and just as scary without showing all the blood and gore. So there's sort of a fine line there. I'm actually producing a couple of involved right now with a couple of films that fit into that horror category. So horror is pretty consistent. So at the same time, I'm out there doing other films that fit into other genres. And again, it comes down to having your finger on the pulse of the town and of the business and the industry. For example, the distribution models have shifted tremendously over the last couple of years. As you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, DVDs were the big thing. You know, you rented them. You used to go into a Blockbuster store and sometimes rent them for $3, $4, $5, $6 and buy them for $20. Nowadays, it's all, those stores are gone, and you rent them out of a machine, and most of the time you don't even do that. You just stream them online. So because
stream them online,
because that distribution model shifted, the whole industry had to shift with it, and it took us a couple of years to readjust to that because it all happened very quickly. And now we are finding that where the recoupment comes from is in the video on demand or the VOD marketplace, because that's basically essentially replaced the DVD market, which is almost virtually non-existent at this point.
Yeah, it has changed fast. I mean, you know, it wasn't that many years ago when they're called video stores, and then they became DVD stores, and now the stores are gone. They're streaming it directly.
Now they're coffee shops.
coffee shops.
I live right here in off Sunset Boulevard. The Tower Records was right across the street from where I live, and it was such a landmark for so many years. You know, it was just this pillar of Hollywood, and now it's just a vacant lot. It's really sad to see that that's what's happened. But again, you know, you got to kind of go with the flow. And I think what a lot of young filmmakers, where they have a tendency to go wrong at the beginning, is not really understanding the distribution format and tapping into that early on. You know, the old model of making movies was that you would go out and come up with a project and figure out a way to raise the money and cast it and shoot the movie. And then you would go around to all the markets, like, for example, the AFM, the American Film Market, which is held here in Santa Monica every November. So there are hundreds, sometimes thousands of filmmakers going around for a 10-day period trying to sell their movies to buyers around the world. And they only to find out that there was no market for the films that they just spent $500,000, $1 million, $2 million to make. So once I started seeing that that was what was happening, I kind of backed up a little bit and started developing and building strong long-term relationships with distributors. And so right now, my model is to go to the distributors early in the process, really early, like the very beginning, when you're in the early stages of development, just getting the project off the ground, and start finding out where the markets are that are going to buy your film and who you'd have to cast in that film to make it a marketable film, and work with the distributors throughout the process instead of waiting until the end after it's too late.
So you get it, you build a consensus, then momentum from the beginning.
That's correct. That's a great way to put it. It's a consensus and a momentum, because in those meetings, I'm sitting with the director, the producer or the producers, the other producers, the casting director, and then I'll bring in a foreign sales representative, and a domestic sales representative. So we got 5, 6, 7 people in that room. That's exactly what it is. It's a consensus of, because a producer will bring me a wish list of the actors that they want to play the lead roles, for example. And the first thing we do is go through that list, find out who has value in the foreign marketplace, because that's really where all the revenue is going to come from to repay the budget.
Yeah.
So we'll narrow it down and eliminate names that aren't going to work and replace those with names that are. And then once we all walk away from that table with a clear understanding of who would be best suited, not only creatively to play those roles in the film, but also at the same time, we're going to satisfy the commerce side of the equation and the distribution and the sales, then we go after those actors because we already know that the sales reps have confidence that they can sell the film once we make it based on those names.
So how do you get someone like Matt Damon, you know, for a movie? I mean, you'd like to have him in a movie, just something that fits perfect with him. How do you position and
well, that's a good question, and it's a tough one to answer, and I'll tell you why. Because, you know, Matt Damon is a bona fide movie star.
Yeah.
He's an A-list actor, and because of that, the tendency is to want to do the big studio films. That said, a lot of these guys, like I said, I did a movie with Gary Oldman a couple of years back. A lot of these guys, they do love, and I don't know if Matt's one of them, but they do love to do the smaller independent films. If it's something that they're attracted to, if they really like the material, then they usually will do it. But here's the biggest, I think, reason why producers, especially if it's their first or second time, it's really, really tough going out there the first or second time, and which is why I partner with a lot of these first and second time producers and directors, because they don't have the track record or the experience. And bringing that in, not just me, but my team of people that I would bring in with me, it really gives confidence to both the distributors and the investors and those kinds of actors. And so the downfall a lot of the times is the producers are going around trying to get the Matt Damons of the world into their films by making offers to be in their movie legitimately through their representation, usually their agent or their manager. But the problem is they don't have any money to back that offer. So even if the agent agrees to pass the project along to Matt for him to read, at the end of the day, even if he were to read it and love it and want to do it, if they don't have the money to fulfill their obligations under the offer that they submit along with the script, then it's not going to happen, number one. And number two, they're going to have trouble getting anybody to take their phone call in the future because they get sort of marked as the guy who made an offer without any money to back it up. So I make sure on my deals that before I go out to any actors, not only do we have money in the bank to be able to justify the offer and the budget, but we actually go a step beyond where we offer to put money in escrow in the account of the agency. Yeah.
Yeah, like real estate, you put the money in escrow to show that you're...
We put the money in escrow. We'll put up $25,000 into whatever the agency's, you know, whoever the agency is, into their account, which does two things. Number one, obviously, it proves that you mean business and that you're real and that you're not expecting them to do you something for nothing. And number two, it gives you a pretty much guarantee that the actual actor, that Matt Damon in this case, is going to read the script and is going to make a decision. If the decision is yes, that they'll do the part, then of course the money stays in their account, and we move through with paperwork and make sure that he gets paid the rest on the offer. And if for any reason they pass on the deal, then the money gets, you know, it didn't go anywhere. It's been in escrow, and we haven't lost anything except what it might cost us for escrow fees to move money in and out. That's the only expenditure there. But it's well worth it if you're going after somebody like Matt Damon.
So you're building consensus and momentum in the process, credibility and trust, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So you've done this now on, what is it, about 20 feature films you've done?
Yes, a little over 20. And I've got eight or nine in development.
In various
stages as well. Yeah, well, in my position, you know, it's important to have a lot of things happening because at any given moment, one could fall apart and then something else takes its place and becomes the star of the day. And then 2 weeks later, they could revert back the other way.
Yeah.
You just kind of got to go with the flow on where these projects take you. And as an executive producer, I'm not required to have to be on set. Of course, I will be on set at least for a certain period of time to make sure everything is going smoothly. But that said, you know, I just made a movie last year that just came out. It actually comes out in July. It's called The Livingston Gardener with James Kyson from Heroes. Small independent feature film. The whole film was shot in Mississippi. And it's completed. It's in distribution. It's going to be available on Netflix and on all the platforms. And I've never to this day stepped foot in the state of Mississippi.
Interesting.
So my point is I can do a lot of that from here. My office is in Brentwood here, California. And so a lot of the work I do is on the phone. It's negotiating. It's emails and meetings. In most cases, I will be out on set for a couple of days at least, but that's the reason I'm able to do five or six projects at the same time, because in theory, I could have four or five films shooting at the same time, whereas a line producer, for example, is committed to that one project for the entire shoot and the pre-production, which could be months.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm looking how the whole film producing systems are evolving, you know, just like the distribution systems. And, for example, what is it, for about a $5,500 camera now, digital camera, that they can do almost the quality that film cameras could do for feature movies here 15, 20 years ago. The creative content, you know, how you work with someone's script, I'm sure you have a lot of people come to you with a script that's just basically a script concept. do you have teams of people that work with you on script development?
I wouldn't call it teams of people. I do have people that I go to for that, and the reason I say that is, you know, you're right, people ask me to read scripts all the time, and it doesn't make any sense to me to read a script, because reading a script, you know, I deal with investors and distributors and talent, and at the end of the day, that's my strength and my forte, so I'm going to defer to the creative people to let me know if a script, you know, comes in with strong or weak, and the term we use is coverage, to send the script off of coverage. So I do have several people that I send the script to for coverage, and the coverage is basically a breakdown, and it tells me whether it's any good or not and what the problems are, if there are any, and it would recommend whether I move forward on a project or not. So it doesn't do me much good to read scripts, because unless there's a deal to be had and then an opportunity for an investor to be able to make money, then it's usually too early. And this is really where the problem lies, is that a lot of writers, particularly writer producers, they think in terms of the studio system. In the studio system, you write a script, and in theory, you could go in and pitch it, and if they like it, they'll write you a check, and they'll either offer to option it, or they'll flat out buy it. And that's one way of doing it. That said, usually in that case, it becomes then the property of the studio, and they're going to do what they want with it. And you, as the creative person behind it, usually get sort of left behind in that situation. One of the beauty of independent film is that you have creative control and complete control and ownership of your property throughout the entire situation. Once investors come in, of course, you start to have to divvy some of that up, but from the beginning, it is your piece of work that you do own. And what they have to understand is that investors aren't investing in a story or in a script. they're investing in a business opportunity to make money. And yeah. So that's where the development process comes in, and that's where I come in, helping these people bring their script. Once it's been covered and it comes back and it looks good and it looks like it's a go, then the hard work begins of turning that into something that becomes attractive for an investor to dump $100,000, $200,000, possibly $1 million or $2 million into. And I have one of the things I say that I've quoted as saying all the time is, getting the money isn't the hard part. Getting the money back is the hard part.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to go out and raise $1 million and make a film, but I have to be able to see the other side, where if we're going to spend $1 million to make this feature film, that at the very minimum, we're going to get a return of, say, $2 million, maybe double the money, so that it makes sense for an investor to get involved.
Yeah. Yeah. For that kind of risk, they're going to ask usually for double their money, don't they?
Well, there's an expectation. I mean, investors are going to get a 20% return, which is pretty high relative to other industries. I mean, the industry standard is 20%. So for somebody to put in $1 million and get back 1.2, it's not bad. But what I often tell people is that's not the reason why they're investing. They're not investing because they're going to make 20%. People who can usually write a check for $1 million like that are looking for much greater returns than 20%. So where the real money comes in is after they do recoup their 120% of their investment, then they get 50% of every dollar that comes in perpetuity for the rest of time. So when you see these small movies like a Paranormal Activity or My Big Fat Greek Wedding, or these movies that we all hear about that were made for very little, small amounts of money and grossed hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
It's that high end that these investors are hoping for, that be way beyond recoupment and 20% return, that they're going to be able to potentially invest that million and possibly make $5 or $10 million back because they believe in the filmmaker and in the project and in the story.
So if they're getting 50% in perpetuity, where's the other 50% on profit?
It's going to the production side. So
production side.
So after the investor recoups plus their 20%, then it's a 50-50 split. Half of it goes to the investor pool. There could be one investor, there could be 100 investors. They're going to divvy that up, split that up amongst themselves. And the same thing on the production side. There could be one production company, there could be three. And those people will share the profits on that side.
Interesting. You know, there's a parallel here to Silicon Valley and what goes on with venture capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of followed that over the years, and it's very interesting how, you know, they will, you know, even angel funds, they'll put money into a project for a very modest return, but when they see that it's really going, they do own the right to buy up, so to speak, and get the larger percentage and in perpetuity, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know of people who are still getting residual checks for tens of thousands of dollars on films that they invested in 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's really incredible. I mean, and that's what we're all after. You know, we're all after that one film that's going to make its mark. And I mean, look at what's happening with, say, for example, what started off with the Saw series, and now Insidious. You know, they're making these, continuing to make these movies because they're very popular with the public and they make a lot of money, and the investors are continuing to reap the rewards. Somebody at some point early on had to have believed enough in that project originally to have put that money in. And if they hadn't, they wouldn't be in this situation. So it is a little bit of a dice roll, but it's no more or less risky than any other investment that people can make. Really, the ideal scenario from my perspective as a producer / executive producer is, for example, if somebody wanted to give me a check for $10 million to make a movie, and people do that all the time, right? That's not a... In the independent industry, $10 million is pretty high for an independent film. My sweet spot is $1 million to $3 million. That's where the budgets lie were on the movies that I make, and that's why they're able to go into profit, because we don't have that much to recoup, and we can do it in a relatively quick period of time. But that said, if somebody was going to write a check for $10 million, what I would do is I would make 10 movies.
You know,
at $1 million a piece, and,
yeah.
and diversify their risk for them, mitigate
yeah.
that risk, and give them 10 opportunities to be able to recoup. And on the law of averages, at least two of those 10 are going to make enough to make up for the losses on the rest.
And this is the example in Silicon Valley and venture capitalists. They'll get, you know, the 1 out of 100 companies that they'll put millions of dollars into, they'll just make them billions.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Just make them. They'll really become huge. And you know, and I'm thinking the foreign markets has got to be a huge thing. So when you said you have foreign investors come into these into these sessions where they're where you're considering developing a movie. The way they translate Hollywood movies now into foreign languages all over the world, the dubbing of the languages has become really advanced, and it's a huge market outside the United States now.
Yeah, particularly in China right now. China is really stepping up when it comes to that. Yeah. Now, that said, they generally do want English-speaking movies, but at the end of the day, when I refer to the foreign market, what a lot of filmmakers don't realize is really that's what we consider to be the collateral on a budget. If somebody writes a check for $2.5 million, we're going to be able to sit down with the foreign sales representatives and find out what the value of that film is in every territory around the world.
Wow.
And then add all that up and see what we come up with. So, for example, we have a $2 million movie, they're going to give me three numbers, low, medium, and high. So let's say the low number was $4 million, the medium was $8 million, and the high was $12 million. Those are the estimates that they're telling me that this movie's going to make when you add up all the territories around the world. So that's not bad. If I have a $2 million budget and the lowest number is $4 million, I know I'm going to double my money. But if the high number is 12 or 15 million, that means an investor is going to be able to invest $2 million and potentially make $10 million, or in this case, $5 million in profit, because remember, they only get 50%. But we're all going to make a lot of money if that happens. And that's a way of being able to help explain to investors. You have to be able to show them where that return is going to come from. You can't just go and say, I believe in this film and I got these actors and I'm going to cross my fingers and I think I'm going to be able to get your money back. You really have to have a business plan that breaks it down. And that's my area of expertise, is being able to take the whole puzzle, put the pieces together, and make it attractive for an investor on the foreign and the domestic side of things.
Do you ever create a trailer just to get the attention of investors?
Sure. Yeah, sometimes people do short films, which is one way of doing it. Sometimes they cut a trailer or a sizzle reel just to get people excited and give them a sense of it. And again, that's all really great. It's really important, and it's a visual that definitely, definitely helps.
Like a teaser.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, that's on the creative side, and it doesn't mean necessarily that the movie is going to do well or make money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It shows that it's going to look good and that we have talented people behind the camera and behind the scenes, and it does demonstrate someone's ability to pull off the job and to do it well, but it doesn't necessarily translate into a return of the investment, which is what I always end up having to go back to.
You know, there really is a big parallel here to, call it Silicon Valley or Wall Street. But, you think of a Bill Gates or a Mark Zuckerberg, who developed Facebook. I mean, they're teenagers. They're school dropouts, or Bill Gates was. And they go on, to develop something that is so huge. And, some movies can be like that. I mean, you think maybe the person is just a kid, but he may have
sure.
something.
Yep.
And it's hard. I can see where it's for investors. It's hard to judge sometimes because the criteria. You know, I mean, who would have put money on pimply Bill Gates when he was, you know, in the garage workshop or a Mark Zuckerberg when you know when they you know when their valuation of what they created. And so creating and producing and directing a movie. I can see where, you know, that if there's a real creative, something new, something, you know, a new genre or something that's out of the box or something that people really want, you know, and maybe if it's even if it's science fiction, so to speak, if they really want to see what hasn't happened yet that could happen, you know, I can see where, you know, that it, you know, it's, again, how it's positioned, packaged, promoted, and you know, there's script and then there's the screenplay, you know, and I guess that's something I was going to ask you about. You know, translating a script into a screenplay is an art form in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I always say when you make a film, there are three films that you make every time you go out into that journey, right? There's the film that you write. There's the film that you shoot. And there's the film that you edit. So the finished product is often very different from the original script or the original screenplay because so many people are going to have their hands in it, right? You're a writer, you write a script, and then you pass it off to a production company, and then the production company brings their writers in, and they make some changes, and then you get a lead actor on board, and then they want to make changes, and then the director comes in, and they got to do their thing with it. And then... So now you could have written an amazing script, beautifully well done, and then you could have even shot an incredibly beautiful movie and done everything right so that the lighting and the camera angles and the technical side of it is all perfection. But then you could get it into the editing room and an editor could butcher the thing and make it look like a horrible movie. Something very different from what you just spent all that time and money making. So you really have to be careful to monitor the process every single step of the way so that you end up, because again, in the financing side of things, if I pre-sell a film to Germany or France, it's based on an expectation of what the movie's going to look like. So I can go ahead and get a pre-sale for $250,000 from some country. I got a contract in my hand, but then I got to deliver that movie that's worthy of that number. And if the movie doesn't come out anywhere near as was expected, then we're going to have a problem collecting that money. So that's why I'm saying that you really want to. If I had to give advice to anybody new coming into the fold. My best advice, and this happens a lot, I get a lot of people that are first-time directors particularly that come to me with a project, usually that they wrote, which is fine. But then they want to make the movie, and they have to direct it, and the budget's $5 or $8 or $3 or $7 million, and it just doesn't make sense. People aren't going to – it's really difficult to get people to support that when you don't have anything under your belt. So what I tell filmmakers, and I've done it now 3 or 4 times very successfully – is I have them work on something much smaller scale, like $200,000 and $250,000, so that and still get a decent actor. It doesn't have to be a big, huge movie star, but somebody with some kind of value or recognition, because it really proves to everyone, including that director, that they can do the job and that they can produce something of quality and that they can work with actors and they can get the best performance out of people, even if it's a movie star or an A-list, B-list actor. And now they've proven themselves, and they will no longer be walking around with that label of first-time director, which can be a curse in this town when it comes to just financiers and distributors. It's a really tough thing to break through. So instead of going for the $5 million movie, you know, go for the smaller one and prove yourself. And then you can graduate and do something bigger, maybe $1.5 million or $2 million the second time.
So you build credibility and trust, and then they buy what you sell.
100%. Or the other scenario is, you know, if you're going to do the movie at $3 million or $3.5 million, go get an experienced director to direct it, and then shadow that director and learn the ropes.
Yeah.
And then at that 3.5 with a named director, you will attract the named talent because the named talent does want to work with a named director. They don't want to work with a first timer most of the time.
You know, I'd like to leap into the future and see where things are going. And I mean, I like to think that even the education system, and it used to be based on reading and writing and arithmetic, that in the future we're going to see, you know, the leaders of tomorrow are going to be the communicators, and they'll have schools, you know, they'll go to in the summer, you know, where they'll learn how to create videos, produce, direct, create, edit their own videos, you know, on their smartphone, if not on their personal computer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's going in that direction. But the skills to editing video, editing so that sound and the visuals and the pacing and the leading and the sequence of persuasion creates a momentum of you know, emotion, energy and motion, emotion. And this is something that, you know, I don't know why they're... We don't see that now, but, you know, you think about it, the leaders of tomorrow will be the communicators, and you'll have people that are able to create videos, and they'll go out on the Internet, you know, and social networks, they'll go viral, you know, because they have something to say. And of course, I see interactive capabilities where people will be able to respond on a mass scale so that any part of a video, you'll be able to see the collective cloud consciousness of feedback from people with three numbers in sequence, correlating to the holodeck from their upper brain, lower brain, left brain, right brain, forebrain, and rear brain, or three numbers, this language of light that I referred to in the video. Some people listening maybe saw that website on Deep Shift Happens. But the concept of the future and how the origination and the evaluation of programs, videos, communications. I mean, it's moving very fast, and it's becoming a global village as far as social networks and social conscience is evolving. And I'm amazed with your expertise in this regard. Film schools usually don't teach a lot of what you're doing. I mean, you know, the whole process.
I say that all the time. I say, you know, film school will teach you how to make a movie. And I'll teach you how to get a movie made. So there's a big difference, right? Because what happens is, you know, I meet a lot of people that come out of film school, and I don't have to tell you, I mean, film school is not cheap. It's pretty expensive. Depending on where you go, it could be tens of thousands of dollars,
yeah,
you know, to get through a couple of years of film school. And I think there's a lot of value there, right? Because I don't have those skills. I don't know how to use a camera. I don't know the difference between one camera and the next, or one light from the other. I don't know the technical stuff because that's not my area. That's not what I do, right? So, on the other hand, they don't know what I do, right? They don't know anything about raising money and financing and distribution. So we need each other, right? So, but I wish they did teach the stuff in film school because what happens is I do get a lot of graduates. And they come to me, and they feel like they're starting from scratch. They're like, okay, I just spent 3 or 4 years and $50,000, but now what do I do? And they still have to go through the process with me of becoming educated on the business side of the business, because if you don't understand that, it is going to be difficult. You know, I teach a course. Sometimes I teach around town when I get invited, but I teach a 6-week course. And it's designed to do just that. It's to take somebody who does have the passion and or a project or a screenplay or had just come out of film school or whatever the case may be, and help them get through those critical steps of understanding, if nothing else, understanding the language of that side of the business and the basic concepts, so that when they're sitting in a room with me and or somebody like me, and they're in a room with also distributors and financiers and whatnot, that they can keep up with the conversation and have the confidence that they understand what's happening and that they're not relying on other people to make their dream come true. They actually have their own set of skills and their own knowledge base that they can draw from, so that they can't be taken advantage of, and so that they make sure that the things are done properly when it has their name on it, which I think is really, really important.
So what you're talking about, this whole process of creating in production, is like the alpha and omega. It's like, you know, the spirit matter, you know, the spirit that, you know, you have to have these two sides, like the yin and the yang. And you don't see that much, you know, usually you see one or the other out there, or actually,
yeah,
with film school, you're just seeing the creative process. And
yeah,
and,
it's left brain, right brain. Yeah.
Left brain, right brain, exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this concept over the years that, you know, I've developed this language of light of consciousness, and how the whole photomechanical process parallels the processes of consciousness. And of course, where the rubber meets the road, you know, on earth as in heaven, you can have the highest ideas, producing it, you know, making it physical, and the financing.
Different story.
And it's kind of like the corporate model. You know, you have your strategic management, and you have your operations. You know, you have your CEO, CIO, and then you got your COO of operations, and your CFO and finances.
Yep, exactly.
So it's like, again, it's like when you left brain, right brain. It's like the two halves of it. And I would love to see, you know, a summer camp for kids, you know, that that parents would send them to. You know, maybe they have river rafting in the afternoon, but in the morning, you know, they have creating and producing and directing videos or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And,
yeah.
And maybe we could get you out for one of those. But
teach a course in financing and distribution.
Yeah. Or somehow work that part of it in. But I think, you know, that vision, that understanding of all these components to the capstone vision of, you know, how you create an independent film and how you can maintain control of the creative process and what you've been doing in that regard, I think it's really, this has been a great way to look at the big picture. But I'm really grateful that you had a chance to come on the show today, Franco.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to people who I know it's in their heart, and they want to learn this stuff, but sometimes they just don't know where to begin, and so this is always a good place to start. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak on the show.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you so much, and hope we have some unfinished business in the future.
Absolutely. You know where to find me. Give me a call. I'll be there.
All right. Thanks, Franco. I want to thank everyone for listening. Happy trails till we meet again. And keep the vision, keep the faith, and we'll see you in a few weeks. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to this presentation on Cosmic Love. I hope you have enjoyed receiving this as much as I have enjoyed giving it. There's a new relationship with all humanity that is maturing with the new synchronicity of instant, everywhere, interactive, net reality. Cosmic Love is the heart of this synchronicity. Tools and processes that empower the wisdom of Cosmic Love is the purpose of the Worldwide Love Foundation. The family of man is now making a quantum leap into a new consciousness as never before in history. Our awareness as humankind is expanding, and the Internet reflects that multidimensional expansion of consciousness into new realms of omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence in the power of cosmic love. This has huge implications. The more information we have, the greater the need to get it all in order. The more knowledge power we have, the greater the need for the wisdom of cosmic love. That should be common sense. And it's time to make common sense more common. If you agree that the American Revolution was huge for freedom and opportunity in the world, look what's happening to the whole world now. A new connection with cosmic love is positioning the golden rule, law, language for a golden age in our spirit, our minds, our hearts, and the soul of humanity. We're on the threshold of a global revolution that is awakening the angels of our better nature. Let's be honest and reason together. Cosmic love has always been the golden rule, law, language for every golden age in cosmic history. Some things don't change, only the ability of the human mind to grasp the full implications of the world in which we now live. That has changed with the internet, and like an adolescent who is not an adult yet, but not a child either, the internet is now installed, operational, and ready to take our personal and planetary consciousness to the next level. That would be cosmic love, and the foundation principles for this is the love model, a universal law language interface for net reality that represents the five-dimensional intelligence that can fulfill a global revolution in higher consciousness. Check it out for yourself. See how it works. Consider the role you can play and how you can benefit. The sooner you get the vision of this cosmic love thing, the sooner you can profit from a wholly new economy that will transform all our social networks with extraordinary abundance of everything held sacred by free people worldwide. There is a new intelligence that is defining and refining humanity's evolutionary ascent. The higher the intelligence of universal cosmic love, the greater the results. The gateway to higher consciousness is, in fact, the language of consciousness. The five-dimensional intelligence that cosmic love frames in form and frequency, as in frequently. Once you get it, how the Holy Spirit of love and action can heal our individual and collective conscience, it will become self-evident how cosmic love can nurture and culture the net reality that brings a Holy Spirit to the collective consciousness of humanity. Love heals all, always has, always will. The more cosmic and universal the vision of love, the greater the results. Welcome to the opportunity. It's time to link the light workers who are love makers. The internet now provides this opportunity for extraordinary synchronicity as will empower wisdom with cosmic love. Someone had to do it. Now you can. Network for the net worth of this new net reality. You have the vision now before you. What you do with it can change your world and the world at large. We are all co-creators in the cosmic scheme of cosmic love. The great spirit of great love is the great opportunity that genuine freedom gives all of us. Heaven knows that there is nothing more valuable than the vision of cosmic love that has found its time. Experience the Worldwide Love Foundation in your consciousness, being, and world. Care enough to share this vision of great opportunity. Step into the circle of global connection as you center and connect with the five-dimensional intelligence of cosmic love that provides the cultural DNA for a golden age on Earth. Miracles happen when cosmic love is conceived, believed, and achieved. You are that miracle when you become the cosmic love you want to see in the world. Own this vision as your own. Embrace the intrinsic virtue of cosmic love. Make the vow to do what you can because you can. Claim the victory for all mankind aspiring to live as kind men. Here's to winning from the beginning of a global revolution that will finish worldwide with the great experiment and representative government gave humanity with the American Revolution. Heaven on earth is virtually in your hands. Do you want the keys to the kingdom? Are you ready to assemble the components to the capstone of cosmic love vision? Discover the five-dimensional intelligence that will empower your own virtually untapped gifts and talents. Consider how you can make a difference, if not the difference. It's your life, your world. Take command. Give cosmic love the chance that you want for all mankind. Now you can. See for yourself. Do it for cosmic love, and heaven knows cosmic love will bless your life far beyond this one. Sooner or later, what goes around comes around. You can call that good karma, or the justice of cosmic law, or just the blessings of cosmic love. It's the same thing. The abundant life is born in abundant love. The more cosmic that love, the more abundant is your life. Personally, I can't think of anything better to do, and I hope you feel the same way. So keep in touch with cosmic love. It only gets better as you pay attention. This is how cosmic love works. Pay attention because attention pays in ways that make cosmic love the new currency for global peace and prosperity. Your attention is your consciousness. The next economy for planetary civilization will pay attention to the value of virtue, the virtue of cosmic love. The family of man and our global village must be connected to this one virtue. We must pay attention to the first principles of higher consciousness if we are to transcend the old paradigms of scarcity consciousness that scarcity economics has created. This is the whole point of cosmic love. We won't heal our personal and planetary problems with the same consciousness that created the problems. The best hope for humanity is the charity of goodwill among mankind. This is the charity of cosmic love and action. This is the Holy Spirit of cosmic love and man that raises mankind with loving kindness. I hope you appreciate this message and share it with others. That may be just your circle of influence with family and friends, or it may be every news group or blog on the internet where lightworkers and enlightened netizens, global citizens, hang out. By the grace of cosmic love, enough good people will do enough soon enough to quickly turn the tide of global consciousness from the paradigm of scarcity to the paradigm of abundance that cosmic love cultures. May the quickening and awakening of consciousness begin with you and your own personal evolution in higher consciousness. Thanks again for listening to Cosmic Love.